Welcome to the Midday. I'm Norman Gilliland, and we'll hear from Andre Watts, in a couple of forms during this half hour. We're going to start with one of his performances of a work by Brahms. He'll be performing this weekend the Grieg Piano Concerto with the Madison Symphony. This performance of the Brahms goes back to 1988 and was recorded in performance at Carnegie Hall. This is the Rhapsody in E-flat. Does that applause sound familiar, Andre?
Well, I don't really remember that particular applause so well, but yes, I remember when that was, yeah.
Welcome, Andre Watts.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
This is from a 1988 Carnegie Hall performance featuring the Rhapsody in E-flat of Brahms. And you're back in Madison after a couple of years.
Yes, yeah, a few years ago.
This time around, it's the Grieg.
Yeah.
Grieg Piano Concerto.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating piece in that Grieg had sort of chafed for many years after that about writing just, you know, little lyrical pieces. But at the age of 25, he comes out with this masterpiece.
Yeah, this big work, yeah, which Rachmaninoff thought was a perfect piano concerto, which is a very interesting comment.
It is, because Rachmaninoff was not one to give away compliments very easily at all.
Right, yeah.
What is it that appeals to you about it?
Well, it is a piano concerto in the romantic vein that has basically everything. You know, it has a big cadenza in the first movement, very virtuosic. It has a lot of concertante playing, interplay with orchestra, you know, soloists, orchestral soloists. It's lyrical. It's interesting that when you say about, you know, all his lyric pieces and the short, you know, pieces that Grieg wrote, there are no very, very long developments in the concerto. It's interesting.
Awesome.
So it is, in that sense, a little kaleidoscopic in its changing. And of course, there is the slow movement is in a way the sort of the gem, you know, the crowning thing in the concerto, in the sense that there you have really the Nordic Grieg. If you go to Trollhagen and where he's buried and where his studio was and all that, and you go out, there's a little. It's not really a jetty. It's just a spit of land, which is almost really level with the water, and if it's still and you see that shine, that glassy kind of water surface and the hills beyond, you get a sense of that quality that you hear in the slow movement of the concerto.
Would that we could all go to Trollhagen and find out where Grieg got his inspiration.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's quite beautiful there.
And he had quite the lively time there, too, I gather, sort of a problem with the neighbors sort of creeping around to see him at work.
Uh-huh. Yes. I think he wanted to be very private, as so many composers do, and that became an issue.
You're still working at Indiana?
Yes, teaching.
How many students can you keep up with?
Well, this year I have 9. Which is, for me, about the maximum that I can do if I still, you know, want to play concerts and give them the hours that they deserve.
And you're doing how many concerts a year? You were up to 150 for
a while. Well, yeah, that's a while ago. It's something, you know, probably like 70 or 80.
That would seem to be adequate.
Yeah, it's still a lot. It's still a lot.
It's still a pleasurable experience for you, obviously, if you're still doing that many.
Yes. I mean, the music gets more and more interesting. The practicalities of getting from place to place is getting old. I'm getting older, and so that travel is less enjoyable, I must say.
There are stories about performers, and I've had conversations with performers about misadventures where travel sort of took its toll, if not on the performance, on the performer.
Yes. I mean, travel is very tiring. I think that nowadays you have to build in more and more safeguards and security in sense of time. Give yourself enough time. There are, you know, weird exceptions. Things happen. I mean, if you substitute for someone, you know, at the last moment, you're on the road somewhere and they call and, can you play, you know, 2 days from now or something. Well, then, yes. But otherwise, yeah, I don't take red-eye flights anymore. You know, I can't survive that. I need a week to recuperate if I do that. So I don't do that. And I don't like to arrive. If there are two orchestral rehearsals, and it's not very far afield, I'm willing to arrive on the, it's an evening rehearsal, on the morning of. But otherwise, mm-hmm. I like to sleep in the town where I'm going to rehearse the next day. It's much safer.
Well, speaking of substituting, there are various famous stories about performers who sort of made their first big splash as substitutes. That was true for you, too. Lothies almost 49 years ago.
Yeah, is that it? Yeah, yeah. For substituting for Glenn Gould. Yeah, yeah.
Do you remember how you felt when you got the call? Was it from Leonard Bernstein?
It was actually from Carlos Moseley, who was executive director, managing director of the New York Philharmonic then. This was in 63. And it was in January of 63. And I was at the music school, I think, waiting to have a piano lesson. I was called into the office. They said, there's a telephone call for you, which never happened to me before or since, I guess. it was Carlos Moseley saying, do you remember me? And I said, yes, Mr. Moseley, and all that. And he said, well, Master Bernstein and I were wondering if you'd like to come down and play the Liszt again with us on, this was a Tuesday morning.
The first piano concerto.
Yeah, the first piano concerto, Liszt E-flat. If you'd like to play it with us again on Thursday night and Friday afternoon. Because I had played it a few months before on a young people's concert. And I remember, I mean, I wasn't trying to be cute or something. I mean, you know, I was 16 and I said, well, I'll ask my mother, you know, and then ask my teacher. And so I went and it was very exciting. I think it was a kind of, you know, disguised blessing for me that there was not a lot of time to think about.
You just sort of go on, you know, yes, your knowledge and your adrenaline.
Yes, and, you know, repractice the piece, hope it's okay. Think about those things rather than, oh, this could be a really big deal. Didn't occur to me
It was a big deal. I mean, even the orchestra applauded at the end.
Well, they were all very nice. You know, they were nice to me. And then the thing was, I played Thursday night, Friday afternoon, and Sunday night we recorded it. And I'd never made a recording before, so I didn't know anything about, which is already ancient history now with our digital, you know, stuff about take one, take two, and splicing and all that. So it was quite fascinating, yeah.
But your career really took off after that, didn't it?
Yeah, that was really the beginning of my career. I think that sort of blossomed purely on the Young People's Concert, but not to the degree. I mean, that was immediately then recording companies and managers and Bernstein had already suggested to my mother that you should go with this management. And then, of course, they came out of the woodwork and she immediately took his advice. And so, and the first year, I think I played like six or eight concerts my first year as a, you know, performing artist.
Sort of ironic in a way, because that's how Bernstein's career took off, too.
Also, yes, with who did he substitute for? Bruno Walter, I think?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think so.
Back around 1944 as a young conductor.
Yeah. Shortly thereafter, I met Glenn Gould, and very charming man, much less bizarre than
he has
people
a
like to say,
yeah,
you know. And very charming and very kind and very sweet and gentle, and he twitted me very sweetly and said, well, perhaps you do owe me 10% of all your performance fees.
Yes, you always have to have that practical side.
Uh-huh.
Well, let's hear one of your later recordings. This one takes us back about 6 years. This is the finale of the Beethoven Piano Sonata No. 13 in E-flat, as played by Andre Watts. Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 13, Quasi una Fantasia. Andre Watts, my guest today, the pianist. And he's also a teacher at Indiana, and you're teaching that, and you said it's a lot harder than it sounds, and it sounds plenty hard as it is.
Yeah, it's a, first of all, a fragile sonata in the sense that, you know, too many things going wrong really destroys the entire piece. And it's, in essence, it's, you know, the two Quasi una Fantasia sonatas, 27.1, this one, and 27.2, The Moonlight.
Yes.
This is more difficult than The Moonlight Sonata.
Well, The Moonlight Sonata has a pretty fast finale.
That's true.
But it's maybe not quite as
it's
much
fairly
going
direct.
On.
Yeah, it's fairly so. Direct, yes. Yeah, yeah.
What are you tackling now as a performer?
Well, I'm in the midst of playing all Liszt recitals because it's, you know, sort of Liszt anniversary year,
sure,
yes.
Yeah.
And we spoke earlier, you know, about substituting. So I was planning to teach all next week, and I agreed to go out to Eugene, Oregon, and play their opener for substitute for an artist, and so I'm going to play Second Rachmaninoff out there, and then the following week I'll be in Houston playing Beethoven 5.
You like those big slamming chords that you get in the Rachmaninoff on the Beethoven 5?
Yes, very different, but those are both, you know, big solo
theatrical
vehicles.
Theatrical, you could say.
I'm sorry?
Theatrical, you could say.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think a Beethoven 5 is, I mean, theatrical in the sense of, in a way, like the Fifth Symphony, in essence, in that sense, theatrical. But a very concrete piece of music, Beethoven 5, the piano concerto.
And Rachmaninoff has those wonderful Slavic chords,
yes,
and the long rhapsodic lyrical passages.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful concerto, like the Second Symphony, actually, with a giant piano part.
And so if you had the ideal student, what would he or she be like?
Well, I think the thing that you enjoy most from students is their enthusiasm for the music, their aliveness, awakeness, and curiosity about finding out more, and real savor, sort of fascination, almost like, you know, having some great food when a new piece of information comes to light. That's primary. Everything else, you know, there are different degrees of physical ability and so forth and so on. That's secondary. I mean, it's very important, but secondary. Yeah.
There's so many young performers who have the technique cold, at least by the time they turn up in public. But you occasionally hear people grumble a little bit about, well, yeah, but there's something missing that you would have gotten from a performer 25 years ago.
I agree to an extent. I think that grumble is always there, probably always has been, and probably always will be. Look, I think it's natural. People who are 17, 18, 19, 20, look, that's what aging is for maturity, becoming more mature. I think in the same way that, you know, wildly, freakishly gifted young people are beautiful freaks in the beautiful sense. Uh-huh. It would be a negative kind of freakishness, and almost in a way disturbing to hear a 19-year-old play like a 50-year-old. I mean, look, take something greater than anything that you see around the idea that what we know about Mozart. Of course, an incredible formed musicality. But, you know, look at the music. You see that even he died at such a young age, but still, you know, there was that growth. I mean, maturity happens. The people are not, it's not like springing from the head of Athena fully formed. It really isn't like that and shouldn't be.
There is a lot of living that goes into musical maturity.
Yes, yes. And when you think about it, if you play something like the second Brahms piano concerto, well, at that point in Brahms's life, a lot of, you know, water over the dam, under the bridge, however those phrases go, you don't really quite expect a 19-year-old to inhabit that as well as an equally gifted 50-year-old. Now, I must say, you know, I recorded second Brahms when I was, I think, 20 or 21. You know, it's okay. It's not about me. If I hear a really wildly gifted 19-year-old as opposed to a, you know, mediocre 45-year-old, even if they're both professionals, of course I would prefer to hear the 19-year-old's performance of second Brahms. But there are limitations. There really are.
Do you see more students burning out today, do you suppose, than you would have a generation ago?
I'm not sure about that. I'm not burning out. I think that maybe not. I think what's different is our society is, first of all, we're very much interested in what is the number one, rather than recognizing that there are many things at the top, and also what is new. If you are last week's news, well, we're going to move on. And that's unfortunate. That makes it difficult for young players. The question of technique is interesting. There was an article not so long ago in the New York Times about, and unfortunately compared, saying that the young players of today have more equipment than players of the past, and using Alfred Cortot as an example. Well, I don't think that any of these, you know, people like Yuja Wang and Lang Lang and those people, they wouldn't be complimented if you said, wow, you play physically better than Cortot. You know, Cortot was a great, great artist who was famous for and many of the recordings we have later in his career, and he was famous for being challenged by the physical aspects at that point in his life of the stuff. You listen to Chopin etudes by someone like, take people who aren't alive, Geza Anda.
Sure.
Tzifra, people like that. I don't know anyone today who has better equipment than those people.
Yeah, beautiful sound for Geza Anda.
Yes,
in particular.
Oh, great artist. Yeah. Fabulous artist.
As is Andre Watts, and he has, been right up there at the top for close to 50 years now. I remember going back a long way, those Columbia recordings, the LPs, if anybody remembers what those are, the Wanderer Fantasy, I think, was one that comes to mind. Great stuff. And he'll be performing this weekend with the Madison Symphony. He'll be playing the Grieg Piano Concerto in A minor, the one and only Grieg Piano Concerto, and one of the great ones. And also on the program, it's an unusual program this time around, John Adams, represented by a piece called On the Transmigration of Souls, which brings in a variety of choral and electronic forces, I'm told. And then also on the program, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, with John Demain conducting. And that set of concerts takes place Friday night at 7:30, Saturday night at 8, and Sunday afternoon at 2:30.
Right. I think that's
okay,
correct.
Okay, we had to reiterate that. Andre, it's always a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. Thank you.